Welcome to those returning and those arriving for the first time. Tonight I'd like to celebrate the Bodhisattva of great compassion. Avalokiteshvara Bodhisattva. Regarder of the cries of the world. One of the great archetypal bodhisattvas. Bodhisattvas, awakening beings, living their lives for the benefit and happiness and freedom and awakening of all living beings. And I use this word archetypal because she was not like a living person who lived in some historical time period like some bodhisattvas. She is just the representation of great compassion. As I understand, archetype is like a quality that's in the unconscious, or even in the collective unconscious. This is maybe how Jung would use it, something like that. And I think that's kind of how these archetypal bodhisattvas are. Like it's the great compassion in our own, we might say, unconscious or true nature, and the collective true nature. So we have Manjushri Bodhisattva on the front of the altar here, riding on a lion, the archetype of great perfect wisdom, the realization and peaceful abiding in vast emptiness with no reference points, nothing to hold on to, spacious openness. So we have that bodhisattva that's kind of like sits zazen with us and encourages our zazen as resting in perfect wisdom. And then in the back of our altar here we have Avalokiteshvara Bodhisattva standing with her vase of sweet dew, Amrita, where one drop is enough to heal the illusion of separation and all suffering and distress among all beings. So wisdom and compassion work together. These two bodhisattvas work together. So here's some stories about Avalokiteshvara to get to know her a little bit. We have these stories like she speaks and tells stories about herself, even though she's an archetypal bodhisattva. These qualities of our own true nature are boundless, formless, and inconceivable, actually. So as humans that are into conceptions and boundaries and so on, it's, I think, very natural for us to personify them as these archetypal forms that look a certain way so that we can relate to them, because we're relational beings, right? So they're not really outside of us. They're not like residing in some heaven realm somewhere, although sometimes it's talked about almost like that. I think it's a way of talking about something that's not outside ourselves, not inside ourself, not in between. She has no location, this bodhisattva of great compassion, and yet she's imminently present. She is our true nature. And therefore we make paintings and figures of her to relate to her, and then we can make offerings of incense, flowers, light, water, and so on, and we can bow and sing her praises because we're relational beings. And it kind of reminds us of this quality of our own true nature. So this great compassion bodhisattva, let's remember that she's not out there somewhere. She's not in here somewhere. She's not anywhere. She's not in some physical form and location and time and place, and yet she can manifest in any physical form and time and place, as she herself teaches. She can manifest in any way to help beings. So many sutras, great vehicle, Buddha Dharma sutras, speak of Avalokiteshvara Bodhisattva. Historians can, you know, trace some of these causes and conditions of how she first appeared in this world. Apparently, her name originally was Avalokiteshvara. Avalokita means to gaze down upon, and Ashvara means sound. So to gaze down upon sound, or and I think sound in this case, people pretty much agree that it means like the sounds of suffering beings. We sometimes say the cries of the world, but literally it means sound. So it's, she regards also laughter and song and meaningless conversations. She hears everything equanimously and with no separation. And the Chinese translated that Sanskrit word Avalokiteshvara into Guan Yin, which literally means same thing, regarder of sound, and sometimes expanded to Guan Shi Yin, regarder of the world's sounds. In Japanese is Kanon or Kanzeon. And so we have various praises to Kanzeon, regarder of the world's sounds, or Kanon, regarder of sound. And then later, I think maybe like it didn't last very long that her Sanskrit name was Avalokiteshvara. At some point in the sutras, she started appearing as Avalokiteshvara, which is usually how we pronounce it now, because I think most sutras are in that form. And in this case, Avalokita is regarder, and Ishvara is like a sovereign or lord, or, you know, one who has free function. And the Chinese translated Avalokiteshvara as Kanji Zai Bosatsu. So like in the Heart Sutra, we chant Kanji Zai Bosatsu, was deeply practicing Prajnaparamita. So that's why she has two names, Kanzeon, Kanon, and Kanji Zai. And they apparently come from these two different Sanskrit sources. So Kanji Zai or Avalokiteshvara is like the sovereign who gazes down. And maybe it was more like her name evolved that way to kind of like exalt her a little more, to give her this kind of sovereignty. So she seems to have appeared around the year zero. It's a good year for archetypal bodhisattvas to emerge from. Somewhere along about 2,000 years ago in these Mahayana sutras, some would say maybe she first appeared in the Pure Land Sutras, Sukhavati Sutras, as a kind of attendant to Amitabha Buddha. And then she started emerging in many, many sutras, these Buddhist teachings. So here's a few stories from the sutras about this bodhisattva. The Great Heroic March scripture, the Sharangama Sutra. Avalokiteshvara, Bodhisattva, Kanzeon, Guanshirin, Busa, arose from his seat. And maybe before we go on, I should stop for a moment and speak about her gender. Because in India, it looks like Avalokiteshvara was male. And maybe it's because it's patriarchal culture, and that's how they thought of these bodhisattvas. So for maybe 1,000 years, she was male. And still, like in Tibetan tradition, she's called Chenrezig, which means eyes, gazing everywhere, something like this. So almost the same meaning. And they regard Avalokiteshvara as male. And then in Tibet, there's a Buddha called Tara that's like, she's born from a teardrop of Avalokiteshvara, and she's like the feminine aspect of compassion. So maybe because, well, we need some like feminine compassion in this tradition. So Tara was born from her tear. And in China, they never discovered Tara, the archetype of Tara, for some reason. But they felt like great compassion has a very natural feminine quality. So she had this gender change from male to female in China. And it looks like around 800 to 1,000, when they trace back when that happened, like her imagery changed, right? So the common form in China and Japan now is like the back of the author. She's has long flowing robes and looks female. But it was around 1,000 years she was male, and in the last 1,000 years she's been female in China, Korea, and Japan, East Asia. Interesting how these things happen, right, and evolve. And it's interesting also that this was like, she had this gender change at what we call like the golden age of Zen in China. And Zen was like this radical movement of rethinking everything. So I've never heard any connection between the birth of this Zen Chan movement in China and this Avalokiteshvara becoming female, but it was around the same time, it looks like, in the same country. So maybe Zen has something to do with this. Who knows? So the sutras, all the sutras are Indian, so they always say he, but we can play with this. Because, you know, she doesn't actually have a physical body, so she's beyond any particular gender. Avalokiteshvara Bodhisattva arose from her seat, bowed at the Buddha's feet, and said to the Buddha, this is the Sharangama Sutra, "Blessed one, I remember when, as many eons ago as there are grains of sand in the Ganges River, there was a Buddha in the world named Avalokiteshvara." There was a Buddha named Avalokiteshvara. "I aroused bodhicitta while with that Buddha." I aroused that altruistic mind of awakening to benefit all beings while practicing with that Buddha, who taught me to enter samadhi through a process of hearing and reflecting. So this may be something, how I got this name of regarder of sounds, because I learned this practice of hearing. And then she says, like, this practice that she learned. "Initially, I entered into the flow of hearing and forgot the place of entry." So I entered into the flow of hearing sound, and I became so one with that sound, I forgot where I even entered it. "The hearing and what was heard both disappeared. Once the hearing was ended, there was nothing to rely on, and both awareness and its objects became empty. Suddenly, I leapt beyond the worldly and the transcendental, and a perfect brightness prevailed throughout the 10 directions. And at this time, I realized two supreme states of mind. First, I united above with the fundamental, wonderfully awakened mind of all the Buddhas of the 10 directions and gained a strength of compassion equal to that of all Buddhas. Second, I united below with all beings in the 6 realms and gained a kind regard for all living beings. So when she could maybe say like merged with sound completely, entered the flow of sound where she didn't even know how she entered anymore, the hearer and the heard dropped away, there was nothing left to rely on. Everything was realized as vast emptiness, and then this perfect brightness had these two qualities of being united with all the fully awakened Buddhas and being united with all the suffering sentient beings in all realms of suffering. So she united great wisdom and great compassion at that point. So that's kind of, you could say, like the enlightenment story of Avalokiteshvara, Bodhisattva. She's also, of course, teaches great emptiness in the Heart Sutra. This is really like a kind of a wisdom sutra about emptiness, but it's taught by the Bodhisattva of great compassion. Because when she realized that body and mind are empty, she relieved all suffering, both her own and all beings. So that's how. That's one way that she does her work of helping to alleviate suffering and misery. We have another sutra, a little bit obscure sutra, called the Great Compassionate Heart Dharani Sutra. In Japanese, the Daihi Shin Dharani Kyo. So many of us are familiar with the Daihi Shin Dharani, the Great Compassionate Heart Dharani. A Dharani is basically a mantra, like a long mantra. And this Dharani comes from this sutra where Avalokiteshvara is teaching like her Dharani. The Dharani itself actually praises Avalokiteshvara and kind of calls on her and invokes her. But this is the source of how this came to be. In this Great Compassionate Heart Dharani Sutra, the Maha Karuna Dharani Sutra, after Buddha said some words, Avalokiteshvara, so this is Buddha's dwelling in the awakening place of Avalokiteshvara on Mount Potala. Have you heard of the Potala Palace in Tibet, where the Dalai Lama would reside? It's named after in the sutras this mountain, Potala, Potalaka, is her dwelling place. China, Putoshan, they say is her, where she lives, is it? Chinese Puto is the Chinese way of saying Puto Laka. So Avalokiteshvara arose from her seat, adjusted her robe, joined her palms toward the Buddha and said, "Blessed one, I have a mantra of great compassionate heart Dharani, which I now want to speak for comforting and pleasing all living beings, for healing all illness, for living beings to obtain long life, for living beings to be wealthy in all ways, for extinguishing all harmful karmic effects, for leaving hindrance and disasters, for increasing the merit of all undefiled qualities, for accomplishing all virtuous roots, for being free from all fear, for fulfilling all good wishes. Blessed one, please allow me to speak it." So for those of us who are familiar with chanting this Daishin Dharani, this is a little context of the great benefits. And we often chant it for memorial services to help people on their way. And it also extends life and heals illness. We have another Avalokiteshvara 10-line sutra that we use for well-being ceremonies. So for both well-beings and memorials, we call on Avalokiteshvara, Bodhisattva. So then she tells this story to the Buddha. Blessed one, I remember that incalculable billions of eons ago, there was a Buddha whose name was Thousand-Rayed King Motionless Tathagata. For mercy and mindfulness to me and all living beings, he spoke this vast, perfect, unimpeded, great, compassionate heart Dharani, rubbed the crown of my head with his golden hand and said, good child of Buddha, you should hold this heart mantra to give great benefit and happiness to all living beings in the future. At that time, in hearing this mantra, I went beyond all these bodhisattva stages and was very happy and vowed, if I will be able to give benefit and happiness to all living beings in the future, let me have 1,000 hands and 1,000 eyes immediately to help. Right after this vow, guess what? I got 1,000 hands and 1,000 eyes in my body, and 6 types of earthquakes happened, and thousands of Buddhas in the 10 directions emitted light. And then Avalokiteshvara says, if there are monks, nuns, laymen and laywomen, many people who wish to recite and hold this Dharani, they should first have their merciful heart open to all living beings. So sometimes I try to think of this when we're chanting that Dharani, almost imagining my heart of openness kind of like bursting forth, and the chanting is sometimes seems more lively then. So then we have the flower ornament scripture, the Avatamsaka Sutra, where this pilgrim Sudana visits 53 bodhisattvas asking about the practice of awakening beings, and of course one of them is Avalokiteshvara. Sudana, this pilgrim, made his way to Mount Potala. Climbing the mountain, he looked around for Avalokiteshvara and saw him on a plateau on the west side of the mountain, which was adorned with springs, ponds, and streams, sitting wakefully on a diamond boulder in a clearing in the woods, surrounded by a group of bodhisattvas, to which he was expounding a dharma called Light of Great Love and Compassion, which concerns the salvation of all living beings. What else would she be teaching? At that time, she was teaching it for countless eons, and we'll teach it for countless eons. And she said to this pilgrim, it's good that you aspire to supreme perfect awakening. I know a way of awakening practice called undertaking great compassion without delay, which sets about impartially guiding all living beings to perfection, dedicated to protecting and guiding living beings by communicating knowledge to them through all media. Established in this method of awakening practice, undertaking great compassion without delay, I appear in the midst of the activities of all sentient beings without leaving the presence of all Buddhas. So, similar to this other sutra where she was united with all Buddhas, complete awakening, where nothing is arising and ceasing, and she was also united with all sentient beings, arising and ceasing. Here she She appears in the midst of the activities of all living beings without leaving the presence of all Buddhas and takes care of them by means of generosity, kind speech, beneficial action, and cooperation or identity action, which are the four ways of Bodhisattva guiding living beings. So we're going to have a class series on these four methods taught by Dogen Zenji later this summer. Generosity, kind speech, beneficial action, and identity action or cooperation. So that's what she taught in the Avatamsaka Sutra, amongst many other things. And then there's the Lotus Sutra, the Siddharma Pundarika Sutra, the Lotus of the Wondrous Dharma, where there's a whole chapter called the Universal Gateway of Avalokiteshvara Bodhisattva. And this is the story how she got her name. At that time, the Bodhisattva, inexhaustible mind, got up from its seat, bared his right shoulder, put his palms together facing the Buddha and said, "World-honored one, for what reason does this Bodhisattva, regarder of the sounds of the world, have this name?" And the Buddha answered, "Good child, if there were countless hundreds of thousands of billions of living beings experiencing suffering and agony who heard of this regarder of the sounds of the world, Bodhisattva, and wholeheartedly called her name, regarder of the sounds of the world, Bodhisattva, would immediately hear their cries and all of them would be freed." That's how she got her name. And then the sutra goes on to say all these problems that people have, if they call on her, she will come and help. Again, it's not so much that she comes from somewhere outside, not so much she comes from somewhere inside. It's like she's this quality of our own true nature already here, but we're often not so aware of this boundless, unimpeded, impartial compassion. But when we invoke her and call on her, we're kind of accessing this quality of our own true nature. If we're bowing to her, it's like small self bowing to big self. It's like living being. It's like a dualistic mind bowing to non-dual awareness, which comes along with this sense of non-separation. We could even say this compassion is just spontaneous response coming from the realization of no separation. That's why wisdom and compassion can't be separated in Buddha's teaching. So those are some stories in the sutras about this Bodhisattva. And then in the Zen tradition, there's also many stories about her with a kind of a different flavor, because Zen has a kind of different flavor. So maybe the most classic example of this, of a Zen story of great compassion, is this case 54 in the Book of Serenity, where there's these two. This is like, again, the Golden Age, Tang Dynasty China, where two Dharma brothers, Yun Yan and Dao Wu, were practicing together. And Yun Yan said, "What does this Bodhisattva of great compassion do with so many hands and eyes?" Because remember now, she vowed to have 1,000 hands and eyes, and she got them. So now she has hands radiating in all directions, and on each hand is an eye to see. It's a beautiful image of the union of the wisdom eye and the compassionate hand conjoined. So this is some Zen ancestors asking how does this great compassion function? What is this, how does this bodhisattva use all these hands and eyes? And Dawu said, it's like someone reaching back for a pillow at night. The sutras don't usually talk that way. But Zen people sometimes talk this way. So, an unusual image of, you know, at night, in the pitch black, we're half asleep, and we realize there's a little discomfort because our head has slipped off the pillow. So, without thinking, without discrimination, we just reach back, find the pillow in the darkness, and pull it back. How comfortable, and we fall back to sleep. This is the function of great compassion. Like reaching back for a pillow at night. Spontaneous, without thinking, without discriminating. Very natural response to discomfort. Doesn't matter whose discomfort. Just responding naturally and simply, and just bringing back the pillow. You know, we don't really, I mean, maybe occasionally it could happen that we wake up at night half asleep, where's the pillow? And it probably slipped away, it's maybe on the other side of the bed. Okay, let's turn on the light, sit up. Oh, there it is. Okay, I think I'll put it, this should be about the right place. Okay, nope, nope, let's move back up. You know, we maybe wouldn't really do that, right? And it's maybe too late, and then we'll never fall back to sleep. So we do this very gently and naturally, just responding to suffering. Also no sense of self and other. It's not like there's me here getting the pillow over there to help this head over here. So it's a wonderful, simple image of this very natural function of great compassion, because it's a quality of our true nature already. This is the Zen perspective. It's not like something that we have to like gradually build up. We just have to let it happen. So Yunyan asks, what does the Bodhisattva of great compassion do with these thousand hands and eyes? Dawu said, it's like someone reaching back for a pillow at night. Yunyan said, oh, I understand. Oh, I get it. Dawu says, what do you understand? Yunyan said, all over the body is hands and eyes. Like they're not some special thing. It's just, you could say our true body is covered with hands and eyes. All over the body is hands and eyes. And Dawu says, you said a lot there, but you only got 80%. Or you only got 8 or 9 out of 10. Or your answer is like 8 or 9 out of 10. And Yunyan said, well, what about you, elder brother? And Dawu said, throughout the body is hands and eyes. Even more all-pervading. Throughout the body, hands and eyes, or some other translations of this phrase is, wherever the body reaches, it is hands and eyes. That has this quality of like, you know, what we're actually touching with the hands and eyes is also hands and eyes. Hands and eyes everywhere. It's not just my hands and eyes helping the blind. Wherever the body reaches is hands and eyes. Passing through the body, hands and eyes, circulating through the whole body, the hands and eyes. The total body is hands and eyes. The thoroughly realized body is hands and eyes. All that's intimate with the body is hands and eyes. And Dogen, we just had a weekend sesshin at Jikoji where we read Dogen's long commentary on this story. And I'll just, one sentence from Dogen I'll just bring out for tonight. He says, know that even though the hands and eyes do not hinder each other, how you use them is how you let them be used. And how you use them is just thus, or is thus. Know that even though the hands and eyes, like wisdom and compassion, don't hinder each other, how you use them is how you let them be used, and how you use them is thus. Emo, thus. So, this is a lot like reaching back for the pillow at night. It's not so much like, I'm going to use my function of compassion now. It's more like we're letting them be used. We're letting the function of compassion be used. We're letting all the whole universe use the hands and eyes to benefit beings. And you can read Dogen's whole essay on Avalokiteshvara for more. But also Dogen is very adamant about making the point that this 80%, saying all over the body is 80%, but throughout the body is the final answer. He says, these answers all over the body and throughout the body are no different whatsoever. They're just two different responses. And 80% is just, is actually complete. How Dogen says it is, when you hear this, you know, 8 or 9 out of 10, people assume that Yunyan expressed 8 or 9, well, he should have expressed 10 out of 10. But if Buddhadharma were like that, it would not have reached today. The 8 or 9 is like 100 or 1,000. It means boundless. From one point of view, it means beyond 8 or 9, or it's not limited to 8 or 9. You should study the Dharma talks of Buddha ancestors in this way. And one way we could actually talk about that that comes to mind for me is anything we say is actually only 80%. You can't really say 100% of how great compassion functions. So, you know, Yunyan said, wow, your answer was really great. And it's 8 or 9 out of 10, meaning like that's as high as you can go in the speaking scale. Right? Because great compassion, you could say, is 100%, but you can't express it in any words beyond 8 or 9. Yeah. So that's one Zen story. Then we have a story of Yun Men, great Chinese ancestor, said to the assembly, hearing sound, awaken to the way. Seeing form, understand the mind. How is this? Bodhisattva, Avalokiteshvara, the regarder of sounds, bought a cheap rice cake with her penny, but when she opened her hand, it turned out to be a jelly donut instead. You don't find that in the sutras either. The Bodhisattva of great compassion only had a penny. And, well, I guess like all I can get with this measly penny is just a cheap, day-old rice cake. So she offered her penny, got the rice cake out. One translation is, you know, she opened her hand maybe to look at it. Whoa! Actually, they gave me a jelly donut, or they gave me an old rice cake, but actually, it's a jelly donut. An old China. I don't know if they had jelly donuts. I think it's manju, you know, in Japanese, it's like a sweet bean cake, more an elegant pastry. A jelly donut. One translation is, you know, she opened her hand, it was a jelly donut. One says, she released it. She bought it and, like, released it. And her hand was filled with maybe thousands of jelly donuts. But she let go of her little day-old rice cake. Boundless jelly donuts rained from the sky. So, again, this is talking about the function of great compassion, in a very unusual way. You just act with what you have. I just have a penny. Whatever I receive is fine. With an open hand, maybe actually wondrous benefit comes forth without expecting it. She didn't say, like, maybe they'll give me the wrong one and give me a jelly donut instead. A day-old rice cake's fine. Jelly donut. Maybe something about this function of great compassion. Here's another Zen story. Baijiang, who was the Zen ancestor known for the saying, a day without work is a day without eating. He established the community work practice in the old Zen temples. And so one day during the community work time in the fields, the meal drum sounded back in the dining hall, and there was one monk who was hoeing the field, and he threw down his hoe, laughing loudly, and went straight back to the dining hall. And Baijiang, who was there hoeing with him, looked over at him running back to the dining hall and said, "Amazing! This is Avalokiteshvara, Bodhisattva's gate of entry into reality." This activity. And later, when he returned to the temple, he asked that monk, "What did you see out there? What did you realize on the fields to make you behave that way, that unusual way earlier?" The monk said, "Well, at that time I was hungry, so when I heard the meal drum, I went to the dining hall for something to eat." And Baijiang laughed loudly. Amazing. Avalokiteshvara Bodhisattva's gate of entry into reality. Hearing sound, awaken to the way. Just respond. Is this really benefiting beings? To just go have lunch when the signal is struck? Without discrimination, without hesitation, without contrivance. Hungry, just having something to eat. If somebody else comes to us hungry with wanting something to eat, can we just respond without hesitation? Not always giving them something to eat, but respond in a, like, the most natural way, coming forth from this natural quality of compassion. One last story. One last Zen story about this Bodhisattva. Linji, who was actually the disciple of, the grand disciple of Baijiang, who was the teacher in the last story. This is a story about the teacher Mayu, who appears at the end of the Genjo Koan, fanning himself. That's how we know this Baoche of Mount Mayu. So he was a successor of Matsu. So Mayu, one time, was in the assembly of Linji. In Japanese, his name is Rinzai, another school of Zen. So Linji is giving a Dharma talk in a hall like this, sitting in the Dharma seat, and Mayu comes up and says, "Of these thousand hands and eyes of the Bodhisattva of great compassion, which one is the true eye?" And Linji immediately says back to him, "Of the thousand hands and eyes of the Bodhisattva of great compassion, which is the true eye? Speak quickly, quickly!" And Mayu immediately grabbed Linji off the Dharma seat, threw him down on the floor, and sat on the seat. Linji got up and dusted himself off and said, "I don't understand. Please explain." And Mayu, who was thought he was finished, hesitated, and then he grabbed him off the seat, threw him down on the ground, and got back on his seat. And Mayu walked away. Of the thousand hands and eyes of true compassion, which is the true eye? Only, we could say, maybe only one hand and eye function in any given moment. So the true eye is the one that's happening right now. Not in some abstract way. It's the response in the moment right now, not in some theoretical way. So some of the Zen ancestors, to demonstrate this kind of immediacy, it's, you know, to even say something would be too late. But to just grab someone and sit on the seat to just express the immediacy of the moment is an expression of great compassion. Is that a loving act, to throw someone on the floor? I think these Zen ancestors were enjoying this kind of thing. We don't know for sure, but since there's a lot of stories of Lin Ji ending up in situations like this, I think he maybe provoked it, prompted these dynamic expressions of appropriate response. So, Avalokiteshvara Bodhisattva, who is she anyway? Any comments? Questions? Concerns? Hands and eyes? It's two hands.
Well, I'm hearing a lot of varied options, which I like today. That's a good thing for me today.
Varied options.
Well, yeah, I mean, I'm
thousand.
There's, you know, there's, I think often when we think of compassion, we think of the pillow reaching back in the night, you know, that helping, hearing suffering and responding, which is very important. But then there's another compassionate act, which is really moving to me, which is Dogen saying 80% is fine.
Mm-hmm.
And
more than fine.
It's more than fine. It's all, I mean,
it's complete.
Is so compassionate because the mind that is always judging not good enough, it's basically saying this is good enough.
Yeah.
And that's very, very, very compassionate. Mm-hmm. And then the third, which I kind of different, I'm thinking with Lin Ji, the compassion of meeting energy, like being met. So, you know, if the encounter is about jostling, he's arising to jostle.
Yes.
And to be met, to meet and be met.
Yeah.
So these are really different examples of compassion, and so it's occurring to me that maybe that's part of this idea of the many hands.
Yes.
It's not one thing.
Yes. Yes, it's not one thing. And I appreciate your commentary that the saying 80% is complete is a statement of great compassion, because I think for us often that's a huge part of our suffering is we're not good enough. Yeah. So 80% is perfect. And this great compassionate statement, and meeting in any way is great compassion, and fully meeting. So these old Zen ancestors, is one of the ways that they would meet really fully. In a little bit rough and tumble kind of way, but you can't say it was holding back, right? Yeah. Thank you. Yes, Patrick.
So when you were talking about Avalokiteshvara's compassion not dwelling anywhere, not inside or outside, it made me think of the 89 earthquake when people were just so nice to each other, and you know, everybody had things to throw out and fix up, and it wasn't just like meeting one nice person and meeting them with kindness. It was if we're just swimming through this jello of compassion, and it was just all around and not located anywhere but everywhere.
Yes.
And it was, you know, all of our natures. It was only realized, you know, for a few days by everyone at the same time. It was really, we just got the feeling that, yes, this is, our nature is pervading everything.
Wherever the body reaches is hands and eyes.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, so it's not limited to any one person. And it's, you could even say it's where we meet and where everyone's working together is the full functioning of the hands and eyes, inconceivably. And I think that particularly the Zen stories about this really point out how ordinary it is,
mm-hmm.
how completely ordinary. Dogen brings this point up too. This function of great compassion is very natural and ordinary, and when we make it too complicated, like, maybe there's something else I should be doing, but I'm not sure what, and I feel maybe something more needs to be done. I think it's really like, if we're thinking too abstractly like that, it often doesn't really help. But that, you know, that meeting in the present with responding, so earthquake's a big one. It pulls people's great compassion forward because so much needs to be done. Yes, Andrew?
Yeah, I've been sort of chewing over on the concept of a thousand hands and eyes. And so one way of saying it, I think you said, was throughout the body, hands and eyes. And what is intimate to the body is hands and eyes. And it had me sort of thinking about our modern concept of the central nervous system. And I was listening to the Alan Watts radio talk hour, which I enjoy, like a Sunday and a Tuesday one you guys might have heard it before. He was talking about how all of the senses in the human organism are kind of like, there's an element of touch, not just feeling, but like light will touch the retina and sound will like tickle the cilia and the cochlea or something like that. Smells will tickle the olfactory nerves, that kind of thing. And it sort of had me thinking that maybe we sort of come in to this existence like hardwired with a thousand hands and eyes. Maybe that was kind of like a way to describe that.
Yeah, nice. Every sense is a kind of touch and a way to meet the world. Yeah, this body, you could say that the whole body and mind is really always just meeting. I mean, it appears this way in the realm of no separation. We could say there's not really meeting because there's no other. But in the appearance of self and other, we're always meeting. We can't not meet. Even in the dark, we're meeting something, sound. So, and in the openness to that meeting, great compassion comes forth. Yeah. Okay, Richard, last question.
I give mine to the general.
Last question.
It just seems very different from the heroic battle between good and evil.
Yes. Huge divide between these like warring camps of good and evil, just natural response, which is, you know, I think naturally beneficial. Say, what is this, you know, is our true nature? I know Richard likes to bring this one up. Couldn't part of our true nature be evil or harmful? But I'd say beneficial, but it doesn't always look nice. Great compassion has no fixed marks. May any positive energy generated this evening be dedicated and offered to all suffering beings everywhere. May they receive the beneficent, compassionate hands and eyes of Avalokiteshvara now and now and now. Beings are numberless. I vow to save them. Delusions are inexhaustible. I vow to end them. Dharma gates are boundless. I vow to enter them. Buddha's way is unsurpassable. I vow to become it.